Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB board meeting held between the 22nd and 24th of July 2014. My name is Mark Byatt. I'm joined today by Steve Cooper, member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, senior technical director. It's been a productive week this week. Yesterday, the IASB issued its final package of IFRS 9 reforms to financial instruments. Today we're going to talk about other things that happened this week, particularly during the IASB board meeting. Let's start perhaps with insurance contracts, Steve. I wonder if you could update us on the discussions.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. There were two key issues discussed at this month. One was to do with accounting for participating contracts, and in particular the possible use of OCI. Final decisions were not taken. We will come back September, October time to continue discussions on participating features with a view to making a final decision around then on precisely what the accounting is. The other issue was to do with the interest rate that we would use to accrete and calculate the present value of changes in cash flows that offset against the contractual service margin. Quite a sort of specific issue. Firstly, on the OCI mechanics for contracts with participating features, the board is considering a number of different alternatives here. This is a particularly difficult problem. It's one of the five areas that we asked for input on in our second exposure draft. There's a number of alternatives in terms of how to deal with changes in underlying items, whether there should be an adjustment to the contractual service margin, whether some of those changes should be presented in OCI, whether and how items should be presented in profit and loss. The previous month, we investigated the so-called book yield approach, which would present some changes in these the insurance contract liability within profit and loss and some in OCI. This time we were considering the mechanics and an alternative approach, which is the effective interest method, which is looking at how changes in discount rate might be presented again in profit and loss and OCI. So really the discussion was more on the mechanics of an effective interest method, not deciding whether to use it or not, but looking at, well, if we were to use it, how would it actually work? And the decision, the issue that we were looking at is how you would go about resetting that discount rate, what cash flows would you take into account in doing that. I'm going to let people read the update for the detail if they're interested in that particular approach. In fact, probably better off looking at the board paper if you're really interested in the detail. But as I say, this was preparatory work prior to taking a final decision on participating contracts. In a little while's time. The other issue was this rate to accrete. The exposure draft, in fact, both of the two exposure drafts said that the way in which you accrete interest on the contractual service margin is to use a locked-in rate. So the rate from the inception of the contract, that would be consistent, for example, with revenue recognition to which we compare the contractual service margin. In the last exposure draft, we introduced the notion of unlocking the contractual service margin for changes in present value. And we had to then consider what discount rate to use to measure the changes in expected cash flows that offset against the contractual service margin, whether it should be the locked-in rate, whether it should be the current rate. This issue was part of the ED. The question of what rate to accrete at was an issue that many of our constituents did raise. It's partly complicated by the fact that we have two alternative ways in which you can be discounting for the purposes of P&L, whether you use the locked-in rate, which is the OCI solution, or whether you use the current rate, which is where you don't use OCI. And many of our constituents that would suggest that they won't use the OCI approach were concerned that by being forced into a locked-in rate, they would have additional work to do because of the complexity of then having two discount rates, one for the balance sheet and all the measurement, and in fact the P&L, but also another one to accrete interest on the contractual service margin. Anyway, it was a long and detailed discussion. The upshot of it is that we confirmed the proposals in the ED. So that is that we would use the locked-in rate for the accretion of interest on the CSM, and we would use that same locked-in rate for measuring the present value of cash flows that offset against the contractual service margin. So those were the two key areas in insurance. There was a minor issue to do with changes in accounting policy, but those are the highlights from our discussions on insurance.
Thank you, Steve. Alan, perhaps we could turn to another important project, that is the disclosure initiative.
Thanks, Mike, and it's nice to have you back too. It's been a while since you've joined us for this. Disclosure initiative, you're right, it's a, as most people know, it's a series of threads or projects to try and improve the overall quality of disclosures and financial reports. Some of the highlights of this week is it's not just about removing disclosures and things. Sometimes we'll find a gap and an area where we want to improve. And one of those is in relation to what some people call net debt, trying to understand the way financing effectively has changed for a company. We are pushing ahead with a proposal to require reconciliation of liabilities related to financing activities. So this is linked into our statement of cash flows, and in particular the financing section there. I think it's very positive on that. One of the interesting things this week was for the very first time we discussed the implications for our IFRS taxonomy, the way we actually electronically tag. It's the first time the board's actually engaged in this as part of the development of the standard, and it's part of a new due process step for us. The other thing, though, we had going to have a slight delay of a month or so before we potentially put the proposal out, and that's because we're looking at one other aspect. And there's some concern sometimes we understand and have requirements for disclosures about restrictions on some assets like cash, but sometimes you can have an unrestricted access to cash, but some consequences if you move it around different jurisdictions or countries and so on. It could be you have to pay tax by moving it. It could be that there's a, for some reason there's an official rate for exchange, so that economically it makes no sense for you to move it. And there is concern that some of those, they're not restrictions, but consequences are not clearly understood by investors. And we're having a little look to see whether we can link in and improve the disclosures around that. If all going well, we should get an exposure draft out towards the end of this year for that. We also, as a group, started to discuss the principles of disclosure, which is one of the mainstays of this, and this is our eventual replacement of IS1, which is financial statement standard, the core one, and the cash flow statements, IS7. We're looking at a series of papers over the next few months that will become sections or chapters of our discussion paper. This time we looked at cross-referencing. You know, again, as Steve said, I think the best thing to do is look at the paper itself and the board paper. It's essentially about whether or not it's appropriate or better for us to allow people to present some information and management commentary and then cross-reference it back to the financial statements. And it gets a little bit tricky sometimes because there might be special risk disclosure documents they entities prepare for other purposes, should you be allowed to cross-reference to that and so on. So we're looking at some general principles. Perhaps one of the more far-reaching things is that we have been asked to consider reopening the financial statement presentation project, and we're hearing increasing calls from people for us to do that. The board had discussed that, and we've decided to add a project to the research program, not called financial statement presentation, but focusing on performance reporting, which is actually what the financial statement presentation project set out to do initially. In 2002, I think, when it was first started. What we're doing is the first step is, and we'll take back to the board in the next month or so, is to put a detailed plan, because we think there's misunderstanding about how far we're actually going in the disclosure initiative. And a lot of the work that was done in financial statement presentation, and the project was suspended in 2010, a lot of that work is actually being brought into the principles of disclosure work. And then similarly, we're doing some work in conceptual framework project, perhaps not going as far as some would like with the way we're characterising OCI and profit or loss, and we'll have to pick some of that up, I think, as part of the performance reporting project. So quite a significant move for us there.
Okay, thanks, Sam. A lot going on there. Another important project, of course, is leases, a joint project with the FASB. Steve, can you update us on the discussions?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about sale and leaseback transactions, then in fact I'll hand over to Alan to look at the lessor disclosure requirements. These were the two key areas that we looked at for leasing. For sale and leaseback, there were a number of issues. Firstly, whether the sale should qualify for a sale in the first place. And if it does, what is then the accounting that should be applied? And in particular, what happens to any potential gain on the sale by the seller lessee in the transaction? Firstly, does the sale qualify as a sale in the first place? Well, we decided that we would look at the revenue recognition guidance because essentially that says under what circumstances would you deem a sale to occur. It's based upon the control principle. So the principle in IFRS 15 would be applied for that. This means that in some situations, even though legally a sale has taken place, because control hasn't passed, you would say that there isn't actually a sale, and you would then account for any cash received in full as financing. If a sale has taken place, then the question is exactly what is going on and how do you recognise any potential profit from the perspective of the lessee, the seller, on that transaction. What we decided there is that in substance, really what's happening is that the seller lessee is selling their interest in the residual asset. Because of the leaseback, the seller lessee hasn't actually sold the right of use. Really what they've done is sold the residual interest. We said that, well, any profit that arises on effectively that sale of the residual interest should be recognized because it relates to the transfer of that residual interest. Control of the residual interest is passed to somebody else. However, any profit which is attributable to that part of the asset which you retain, which is the right of use, well, that part of the profit wouldn't be recognized. That's a bit of a change from current accounting, where if it's a finance lease back, you do recognize the profit. The other way around, if it's a finance lease back, you don't recognize any profit. If it's an operating lease back, you do, which of course creates the bright line between recognizing and not recognizing, depending upon the classification, to a system that doesn't have the bright line, but instead reflects a profit which reflects the extent to which you've sold that residual interest. The other related issue that we discussed is off-market transactions. This is where you do a sale and lease back, but the actual formal selling price isn't at fair value, is on an off-market basis. In that case, we essentially carried forward what we have in existing accounting, and that is that you adjust the transaction to a market basis to avoid any distortion to the profit that would arise on the sale. So what this means in effect is that any deficiency in the selling price compared with fair value is treated as a prepayment of rent. Any excess of the sale price over and above the fair value is treated as additional financing provided by the buyer lessor to the seller lessee. So that's the accounting for sale and leaseback transactions.
Okay, thanks, Steve. And we had a look at disclosure requirements around lessors as well. It's a joint project, partly with the FASB, and I think we got shared agreement on what the disclosure requirements ought to be. For the case of those leases, I know we call them type A and type B, but really for the leases, we're using the old terminology, like an operating lease where you're renting out the equipment, they will be classified as property, plant and equipment. The requirement is that you need to separate those that own from the ones that are used by the lessor. The other thing too is this was not as widely supported perhaps, and I think for an interesting reason, is that there's going to be a requirement for maturity analysis of the undiscounted cash flows for lessors less receivable for each of the first 5 years, and then a total for the rest afterwards. It's not that people don't think, board members don't think those disclosures are important. I think there's a concern now with discussing disclosure more generally. Every time we have a specific standard and you put in very clear specific requirements, almost creates, it's another thing you have to disclose. And perhaps we ought to sort of step back a bit and think more generally and say, well, this is a financial instrument like other receivables. We should have a general requirement to show maturity or collection analysis, and then allow people or specify that you must disclose material components of those financial instruments or receivables. So again, The fact that the majority of both boards voted for this rather than the full unanimous support doesn't mean they don't think it's right. But there is a concern now, and I think it's good that and healthy they're thinking about this more generally about disclosure, trying to make sure that we don't increase the burden for people.
Okay. Thank you for that. That leaves, last and not least, conceptual framework. So, Steve, perhaps you could talk us through that.
Yeah, it was
start off, isn't it? Because it was 8 hours of debate, I think, Steve.
We had a long session on conceptual framework, so I'm going to do part of it, and Alan will do some parts as well. Let's start off though with other comprehensive income, particularly challenging aspect of the framework. No guidance at the moment in our existing framework, and we're trying to provide some guidance on when and how the board should use OCI in the future. Now, we had a discussion on this, in fact, last month, and the board took certain decisions then. And the discussion we had this month was aimed at providing further clarification, giving additional input that the staff will use in actually drafting the exposure draft, the component of the exposure draft dealing with other comprehensive income. So it was trying to really put more flesh on the bones of what we started the previous month. The key decisions were the circumstances where the board would not be able to use OCI. We have a presumption for including items of income and expense in profit and loss, and that we wouldn't be able to rebut that presumption for items of income and expense arising from cost-based measures that are used for assets and liabilities. That leaves the use of OCI for remeasurements, where we're not using cost-based measures. And the idea there is that we would confirm that we would only be able to use OCI, so rebut a general presumption of putting things in P&L, if it enhances the relevance of profit and loss as the primary source of information about an entity's performance. And there was a long discussion about exactly what we meant by that, about performance in single periods, performance over time, what the relevance of recycling is, to the enhancing the relevance of performance within single periods and over time. And that discussion will be used by the staff in producing the drafting, as I said. Also, we discussed the idea that the whole use of OCI is effectively an application of the classification, aggregation and disaggregation principle that we have for presentation and disclosure. The whole point of accounting, of course, is to aggregate things from individual transactions into summary numbers that can be made sense of by the users of financial statements. But also part of the idea of financial statements is to, at the same time, disaggregate and present components of profit and loss, changes in value in such a way that things become meaningful. And we confirmed that the use of OCI is a tool to help us provide the appropriate type of aggregation and disaggregation to make financial information more understandable and useful. That was OCI.
Right, and measurement. Thanks, Steve. Long discussion. I think we're probably about 3 hours on measurement aspects. And again, encourage people if they want to look. We have several papers, I think three papers, covering measurement this month. Essentially, the objective and effective qualitative characteristics was the first thing, and we have got an agreed objective, and essentially, in that it's the process of quantifying in monetary terms information about resources of the entity, the claims against the entity, and then changes in those resources and claims. Really, what this boils down to is when you've got a conceptual framework, what you're trying to do is set up some principles that guide the board to pick an appropriate measurement attribute. So when you have a particular standard, do you measure something in a particular way? Is it based on transaction amounts or historical costs, as we call it, or is it based on some more current amounts, and how do you go and measure those things? It's quite a lot of detail about the way the qualitative characteristics work, but I just want to mention two, just to give it a flavour of the type of discussion. One is about uncertainty, and what the board's agreed is that the level of uncertainty associated with a measurement of an item is something you have to think about. But just because it's got a high degree of uncertainty doesn't mean that it's actually not useful in itself. So you might have a situation where You have quite an uncertain outcome, but it is better to actually attempt a measure and then disclose information around that than give something like a number that we know for certain, like which could be the transaction price, which is completely irrelevant. In other words, it's not very helpful in terms of making a decision. So
it could be zero.
It could be zero. We know it's zero because we're given it for free, so absolutely it doesn't help us with a decision. So those are the types of things that we had a look at, and these give sort of the parental statements that help shape. But we did have a bit of discussion about cash flow based measurements, Steve.
Yeah, so we had a specific discussion on cash-based measurements, which was quite interesting. Many people think of measurement as, well, you're going to have cost-type measurement, you can have fair value or some other market price-type measurement. And then there's something else that we loosely called cash flow-based measurements, which is difficult to identify as being a market price, but it's still some type of current value. And we have a number of areas in financial reporting where these things are used. In measuring a pension liability, measuring an insurance liability, measuring a non-financial liability under IAS 37. Unfortunately, each of those three standards or proposals in the case of insurance do it slightly differently. And the question for the board really was, is a cash flow measurement basis an attempt at approximating or calculating one of the other measurement bases that we can identify, like enterprise, exit price, fair value, or should we just talk about cash flow measurements as a category in their own right? Well, we had a long discussion of it. We talked about providing additional guidance on the different approaches to deal with uncertain cash flows, about the use of discount rates, and also how to decide when a measurement of a liability should include the effects of own credit. So I think that sort of moved us a step forward in terms of how we will describe these cash flow measurement bases in the framework. I should have said that normally cash flow based techniques would be implementing one of the measurement bases that are described within the framework itself, such as fair value, entry price.
Exactly. Liability and elements generally we had a look at as well. Probably the biggest discussion we had was around the liability definition. If anybody listens to the board meeting itself, it's quite a relatively short discussion, quite succinct, but I think it's worthwhile reading the papers. They're very good on this. The board's decided that the definition of a liability... tentatively decided that when you have a present obligation, then as a result of the past events, it's because the entity has no practical ability to avoid the transfer, and the amount of the transfer is determined by reference to benefits the entity has received or activities it has conducted in the past. I think probably the most important words in there are no practical ability to avoid the transfer. And I think many people will interpret that as being that it's a slight broadening potentially of the definition of a liability, more would be caught than previously was. The important thing is that there's the recognition criteria. It's up to the board to then work out for a particular standard or a circumstance what no practical ability actually means. We have some general guidance that we're going to place in the framework, and again, I'll highlight a couple of these. One is the situation is an entity could have no practical ability to avoid a particular course of action, include those in which all courses of action that avoid the transfer would cause significant business disruption or economic consequences significantly more adverse than the transfer itself. In other words, you would have to cause more harm by not actually doing that. And similarly, if the entity that prepares financial statements on a going concern basis has no practical ability to avoid the transfer, could only be avoided by liquidating the business or ceasing trading, then that's essentially, again, another case of no practical ability. And we're going to have to then consider the implications of this and have a look through some transactions and some scenarios, I think.
I think that this is, Alan, this is an important area because this does represent a change to the existing definition of a liability, which is very much based upon the contractual obligations. So if there's any doubt about the ability, if you are able to in any way avoid even if it would harm the business to do so, then you don't have a liability. And that has created some difficulties in the past in a number of projects. So this represents a real change. In the exposure draft, we had the so-called approaches 1, 2, and 3. What we're discussing here is something close to 2 and 3. Approach 1 was the existing approach in the current framework. And as you say, the board will have to think about what the practical implications of this is if we were to put it in the exposure draft and then confirm it in a final framework.
Yeah. So that's all interesting. And of course, the couple of other topics that we discussed as well as the liability, I think, two, just want to highlight. One is the transition and an effective date. You know, for a framework, we have to consider the effective date. And yet this framework is, a lot of it is for the ISB to help it set standards. But of course, entities do pick this up and apply that through our hierarchy if there's no specific standard and they can't analogize to other similar transactions in our standards, then they fall back on the framework. We're going to be taking that to the Interpretations Committee and discussing it with them as well, because the Interpretations Committee also works with our framework, and so we're going to have another discussion next month about that. Steve, I can't think, that's probably the most of the issues we've discussed on that.
Yeah, I think we've been pretty comprehensive on that. There were other components which are perhaps are less important, but the important thing is that we're making pretty good progress on the framework, even the difficult areas like OCI and measurement. So I think we're well on course to producing an exposure draft on a timely basis. We do have more to do on measurement, though, and that is perhaps the most difficult decision, which is when to use a particular measurement basis, and papers on that will be coming, I think, in September.
Yep.
Okay, thank you for that. We look forward to seeing the papers. It's a very useful wrap-up of the board discussions. Perhaps, Alan, we could ask you just to talk about any upcoming events.
Well, it's not unusual for us as an organisation, but it's an unusual month for the year because August, we don't have public meetings of the ISB. So we have a relatively quiet month. So the next podcast will be in September. But September is going to come, and it's a fairly tough month for us. I think if you look at the meetings page, it's the best way to keep track of that. But you'll actually see that we have Interpretations Committee meeting in September. Followed very shortly after that by ASAF, the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum, is meeting here again in London. And that's almost immediately followed by a World Standard Setters Conference it's the 29th and 30th of September, Monday and Tuesday. As the World Standard Setters wraps up, another group called the International Forum of Accounting Standard Setters will continue to meet on the Tuesday and Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the 2nd of October, we have our inaugural research forum. We have a forum in conjunction with ABR, Accounting and Business Research, in which academic papers will be discussed in a forum at Sage Business School at Oxford University. Anybody interested in that can go to our website, to the Research Centre, and you can register your interest to go to that forum as well. So it'll be it's a very busy 2 or 3 weeks once we come back.
Okay. Steve, Alan, thank you for your time. That leaves me to give the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which is available to download from the IASB website. Thank you.